My name's Anthony Bearden, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, man. I love the set-aside prayer. I try to pray every time before I get up here, and I really ask God, please use me as you see fit. And I try, like, to ask God, just like, please help me stay out of the way from what you intend me to be. Tonight, and if his use for me is to make a complete ass out of myself, so be it. So if I screw up, you guys can blame God. So I have a sobriety date. It's September 1st, 2004. I have a sponsor who's aware he's sponsoring me. I think that's pretty important. And I've had the ability to be part of life. I've had the ability to just try to see how I could be a friend, you know. Regardless if I'm called a sponsor or not, like, I love this deal. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous this time around. Before I get any further, I may miss this, but I think it's important that everyone knows, and welcome to, you know, people new to the group or new in AA, there's a way out. There's a way out. And that's just not to new people either. Like, there's a way out of us being in our own way. No matter how much time we have, what I find out the longer I stay sober is the more I don't know. And it's, you know, my grand sponsor was Tom Flynn, and he had passed away. And one of the cool things Tom said before he passed was, you know, what happens the longer I stay sober? We're like, what, Tom? And he's like, the more refined my bullshit becomes, you know, which is awesome. Very humble thing to say. But there's a way out. There's a way out. And, thank God I found it, but it took someone to show me. So I'll get into my story. I'm born and raised in, South Philadelphia. It was basically me, my mom, and my sister in a small, apartment. We went from apartment to apartment. And, you know, I say that my dad really wasn't around a lot. He was doing his own thing and taking care of himself, I guess, and, you know, his vices, I guess we'll say. you know, we bounced around a lot and we didn't have a lot. And I say that because, you know, I hear a lot of people saying they were born alcoholic. And, you know, that may change my perception sometime. But for a long time, I thought I was born alcoholic. And one, I think, you know, you got to discover that compulsion to not stop drinking. One, two is I do remember being a free kid, you know, and we didn't have much, you know. I remember seeing this world as it was just this huge place to discover things and get in trouble and who cares. I was a kid, you know, and, but it did change. You know, at a certain age, I started developing these ideas that no matter what I did in this thing called life, I'm just not going to measure up, you know. And I started noticing, anyone ever realize when someone's thinking at you? Seems to be a typical alcoholic trait. I started thinking and noticing people noticing me, and they didn't like what they saw. You know, and I started looking myself in the mirror at a very young age, and I didn't like what I seen. So even though my head told me that I'm not going to make it in this thing called life, no matter how hard I try, there was this huge, you know, fear of that, but then this anticipation to do whatever it took to try to at least gain someone's approval, you know. So the first thing I did, I basically became the class clown. And, I remember, you know, my head became such a prison and I couldn't even complete a straight thought. They wanted to put me in a learning disability class, You know, I would walk into school and my teacher would ask me, "Mr. Bearden, do you feel like learning today?" And I would say, "Nope." And she'd point me to my principal, the desk outside the principal's office. Like I had my own personal desk, like just for me. And the main reason why I loved going to the principal's office was one, the older kids who were getting in real trouble were there. And two is when I'm around my peers long enough, I have this sense that the jig is up and they know who I am and I got to get out because I'm just this piece of crap, you know. I'm never going to measure up. I would be convinced that, you know, if I got my best friend here I grew up with and he introduces me to his new friend, I would be convinced that they're better friends, they're best friends, you know. And that's just like people talk about feeling different. They come up here and they say, you know, I just felt different. Me, I wanted to be different. You know, I wanted to stand out. I was an attention seeker, you know, like I wanted whatever type of attention that could be, I'm fine. But as long as there's some kind of attention towards me. But what I can say is that, you know, before I even picked up a drink, it was extremely painful being me. You know, it just was. My light just completely sucked and everything in it. And my perception of this world started becoming from that, you know, huge, cool place to just smaller and smaller and smaller until like I'm in the corner of my bedroom. And what do you do then? My dad finally came back into the picture full time. We're, you know, from South Philly. My dad and his side of the family are illegal entrepreneurs. They wore suits, they drove Cadillacs, they demanded fear and respect out of people in the neighborhood. And he got some kind of deal going on. I don't know what happened, and he ended up getting back in the picture and landed us a house. And I talk about this as my first real spiritual experience, I believe. I guess somewhat. But it was definitely my first night of freedom. And it took place when we moved to this house, and I was introduced to my first room that I didn't have to share with my sister with bunk beds. And I was introduced to this room, and they said, "How you like the room?" And I'm like, "I love it." And it wasn't the fact that I had privacy, it was the fact that it had a window that led to a roof that led to an alley that one night, if I get enough guts, I'll sneak out and seek some adventure. Well, it took a week. I think I got caught smoking or something like that. I had one of my dad's ashtrays in my bedroom or something like that, and it's this big thing. And once again, you know, I finally found a way that I'll show you. When it's painful being me, if I don't get what I want, you're the enemy, you know. And you know, my parents, when they told me no enough, they were the enemy. They no longer knew who I was hanging out with, where I was going, what I was doing. Not a truthful word was coming out of my mouth. And you know, so I'm in a week in this house, and I call up a friend who was a new kid at school. And the reason why I called this kid, we immediately became friends. And the thing is because at the time, you know, the essence of a man in South Philadelphia is someone who can hold their hands and hold their liquor. And, you know, we all learned to box. I have cousins that were in the Golden Gloves. You know, I started to develop a reputation for myself around the neighborhood and fighting and stuff. And, you know, so this kid was getting picked on. He was from brand new from a different school. And, I'm like in the 7th grade. And I started picking up for the kid. And the reason why I picked up for that kid was because I felt like the new kid at that school the entire time. And we immediately connected, you know. There was a clean slate. We were both equally the same amount of loser, I guess. He didn't have a curfew. His mom had so many kids, she would just like kick him out and say, "Don't get arrested," you know? And so I called him up and said, "What are you doing tonight?" He goes, "Oh, I don't know. What do you want to do?" And I was like, "I don't care. Let's go out and do it." So we decided to celebrate this guy, Crazy Ed, a Dominican guy, a Fifth and More. He would sell old E-40s outside the back of his store. So, you know, we got our school bags and got a couple 40s and, you know, and we're drinking and stuff. And, you know, the magic still didn't happen just yet. It wasn't like I put it to my lips and like all this, you know, magic happened yet. Because there's been times where I had alcohol. Like I had cousins that thought it was hilarious getting the little ones drunk on New Year's Eve, you know. But for some reason, it clicked for me this night. So I'm drinking with them and I'm getting tipsy. And same thing, like same physical attributes was affecting me as everyone else on the planet. You drink a little bit, you drink, you know, you get tipsy, you drink more, you get drunk, you continue to drink, you get sick and then hungover, all that stuff, you know. Well, I was at the tipsy phase and feeling okay. And I noticed it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And by the way, I'm like 12 years old. I'm a month shy of my 12th birthday. And I'm like, man, I think I got to get home, you know? So I started walking and I wanted to make this beeline through this park. And it's Dickinson Square Park in South Philly. And there was a cop parked in the middle of the park and I didn't want to get nailed for curfew. So I looked to my right and there was all these guys. I knew of them. I didn't know them personally, but I knew they were the gangster type of guys from like Fifth Street, you know, urban gangster, I guess you could say, not like my dad's crew. And you know, so I look and I'm like, man, if I have to pass by these guys, but it came down to either I'm gonna walk past these guys and they might kick the crap out of me, or I gotta face the cop, you know. So I picked the guys and I started walking. I tried to walk across the street from them and they were yelling over to me. So I'm like, these guys are crazy. They're gonna kick the crap out of me in front of this cop, man. This is nuts, you know. So I walk over to them. And they're like, yo, kid, what are you doing around here? And, you know, me, I got the hat to the back. I'm trying to play it off like, yo, you don't know me. I was just hanging with my homie and, you know, all this stuff. And they're like, kid, why don't you sit with us before you get killed around this neighborhood this time of night? And right then and there, I felt like I made it. You know, what kind of story am I going to have for the kids at school? Actually, screw the kids at school, you know. So that lasted for about 5 minutes. sitting there thinking and thinking, like, these guys can't honestly want me to hang out with them, you know? So I asked them, I was like, hey, you guys like Heineken? And they were like, yeah, you can't go wrong with Heineken. Hell yeah. They were drinking, I think, Coors Light or something. And I was like, I'll be right back. Ran all the way down Momentum Avenue, snuck back at my parents' house, snuck down in their basement, grabbed a case of Heineken from the basement, got it over the yard wall, over the alley gate. Now I'm running down Momentum Avenue like 2:30 in the morning. I'm 12 years old with a case of beer for these guys. They felt like it was time for a celebration. So we packed like 4 or 5 carloads in, more Coors Light, and we went down to Franklin D. Roosevelt Park. We call it South, down the lakes in South Philly, and we broke into their pool. And I had a 15-year-old girl on my shoulders playing chicken with these guys. And I think my drinking career was off to a great start, you know. I wanted to experience that night every night of my life because the magic happened for me. The magic happened for me. You know, I was so concerned about these guys, what they thought. I was so concerned about maybe should I get home, you know, my parents. I was so concerned about that officer and all this stuff. And it completely went away, you know. That I consider miraculous for someone who's been walking around just like knowing it's just extremely painful being me. And I was no longer concerned what these guys thought or anything. I was just in the moment and having a blast. And the thing that I found out though, and the effect that alcohol produces for me, and it talks about our link in our literature about how the alcohol drinks for the effect produced by alcohol. It's not just the physical attributes. It's not just that it allows my shoulders to rest a little bit, you know. What alcohol can do for a guy like me is life can be kicking the crap out of me, and every one of you guys are staring me in the face, talking out of tune, and the voices are getting louder, and I can't even concentrate for a second, and life is kicking the crap out of me. And with a number of drinks, I could drink all you away like that. That is something that I had to hold on to with dear life. You know, it just made sense to me. And after you ever see someone, you ever hear someone say, I don't have another run in me? Yeah. I don't know about, you know, because all my life, like that, just how I never felt like I was going to measure up, my entire life has been this measuring scale. You know, and when I'm talking to you, I either have to find a way, whether it's lying or, you know, just manipulating, whatever, I have to find some kind of way to at least be even. But the average, you know, what I shoot for is way above. And when life is kicking the crap out of me and the measuring scale is all the way down here and there's no way I can produce anything to become equal, it just really makes sense picking back up, you know, no matter what, because it just makes sense to me. I know what is coming by picking up the first drink. I know, you know, I'm willing to trade, you know, family, friends, exterior things, whatever, like that pain gets great enough. You know, for a long time, I didn't know that's what alcoholism was for a guy like me. I thought that I was just completely hopeless and done, you know, and there wasn't a shot for a guy like me because there were so many times I had every reason in the world not to drink. And for some reason or another, even if the people, you know, the relationships that I start developing and people are looking up to me, man, wow, he's doing so good. And for some reason or another, I can't put my finger on it. I pick up again and they look at me and now they're looking down at me saying, how could you? And I don't have an answer. I'm like, I guess this is just how it's going to be for a guy like me. And that feeling right there, that is what drives me to the gates of death. That's what drives me back to Kensington Avenue. And I can stay there and I can dwell there because it's, I don't have to face anything, you know. And I know that that's coming, but I'm willing to trade. I'm willing to trade because for me, that measuring scale, I know for some, you know, within the matter of minutes, I can pick something up. And like, there's not even a scale in front of me, you know. I don't care. And that's much more attractive to me than continuing the fight, you know. You know, that was my first real, you know, experience with freedom. And I realized, you know, what alcohol did for me that night. You know, whether my dad's flying off the handle, I can't sneak out. I could be in the corner of my room and drink, you know. And it's okay. I don't care, you know. And it progresses. And I ended up developing this relationship with this girl. See, my parents both had to work during the day, so I would throw these parties at their house when I was supposed to be at school. And I was cutting school one day, and I started my own illegal entrepreneur business. And I was cutting school one day, and I'm on the bus, and I had this black school bag with a whiteout pen that I drew a weed leaf in on the back pocket. So when I walk, I'm about to get off the bus after I seen like this real hot girl walk on the bus, and from the back of the bus, I hear, "Yo, nice pot leaf," and like I was frozen, like, "Oh my God, dude, that chick just said that to you," you know? And I was stone sober. So, of course, nothing that came from me could actually interest this girl. So I turn around and I'm like, I got a lot of it. Do you want some? So our love started in a cloud of smoke, needless to say. You know, that was the second thing I felt I had to hold on to with dear life because those nights I couldn't sneak out, the nights that my dad's flying off the handle, she's on the phone with me telling me I love you is going to be okay. You know, and I felt that that was like, you know, so important to me because, you know, I had experience with love to some degree with like family members and aunts and stuff like that. And I just always took it for granted. Like, they're supposed to love me. You know, there wasn't anything special about that to me. You know, this girl didn't have to. And a piece of crap like me, I better hold on to someone like that. And by the time I was 16 years old, we were together for like 2 years and involved in a lot of illegal activity and all the stuff that comes with that. And, you know, my dad, he had his own thing going on in the house, and I brought some, she got disowned from her parents, and they sent detectives over my house because I was keeping her in the basement without my parents knowing, and that came to the house, and my dad was just like, "We can't have this here." Not because just like, what I was like getting into or anything like that, but because my dad's business or whatever. I remember them saying, "Anthony, we love you. We want the best for you. Be a doctor, lawyer, go to school. We'll do anything we can to help you. But we can't watch you do this. So you have a choice. And there goes the door if you choose not. But the first thing you got to do is get rid of that girl." And I looked at them once again. Here goes the enemy telling me no. And for a long time, I thought they kicked me out. No. What I didn't realize, because I was thinking of me, was my brother was addicted to crack cocaine and alcohol, and he was missing. And he's much older than I am, and they've already been through this. And they can't take it anymore, and they know what's going to happen with me. And they had to show me the door. I have a 5-year-old son, and I cannot imagine having to say that to my son. Can't imagine it. People say you gotta let your kids go, and I know I'm in AA, and I can say all I want about, I'll have the tools and all that stuff. Every fiber in my body is going to want to go get my son. And they had to say that to me. And I just looked at them like, "You're the enemy. I'm fine. I'll see you later." And I'm 16 years old. My girlfriend's 15. I have no idea where I'm going. But I got this. So she had a friend that lived in another section of the city. So I said, "All right, sounds like a great idea. Let's go." Well, that ended up being 1939 East Somerset Street, and this was in 1997. It's in between Frankfurt and Emerald on Somerset. Wow. Kensington's a dangerous area, these days. But let me tell you, then it was a war zone. I mean, police didn't come unless there was an officer down for being stupid and walking through that area or whatever. Here I am in the middle of it, and we could only spend one night there. And she said, "But you can go to my grandparents' house," her friend's grandparents' house, who were not an English-speaking family. It was a Spanish family, and they lived at 2912 D Street, which is in between Cambria and Indiana. And that's where I spent my first 6 months in Kensington. And from there, I wasn't welcome in their house, I ended up on the streets. So I was back and forth. Everything you could think of, and it comes with all that, for probably close to 7 years. Institutions, jail, trying to get my parents back, all that stuff, and it was hell. And this girl was with me the entire time, and until the end, towards the end. This girl I left my family for, she was 21 years old, and she died. She died of endocarditis, and I swore off everything, by her hospital bed, saying, "Oh, we're going to get married. If you pull through this, like, I'm detoxing, and I stay sober for 2 months watching her." And she was taking a turn for the worse, and they asked to call her folks, and they had disowned her, hadn't been around in 6 years. So they had to call the folks, and the folks came, and they had me removed by the police. And I call a friend, and I ask them, "Please, can you go check on Jill? you know, I can't show up. They won't let me. And he's like, okay. And I call him the next day. I'm like, hey, how's she doing? I know they're introducing this new medication. I know she's in a little bit of bad shape. And he's like, Anthony, she's dead. And I said, what happened? And he said, the mom was in the room. She's on life support. They said, you know, we'd like to introduce this new antibiotic. It can help. And she said, no, thank you. And she had them pull the plug, 21 years old. Lost my mind. That was the only thing on this planet that I thought made sense to be in my life. Like, I can deal with maybe doing this thing together. Like, how many couples and how many people that begin this journey thinking me and my significant other can fight this thing together? Not a shot. And believe me, I have some pretty strong will. I lasted enough out there with everything that Kensington has to offer and can throw at you. And, you know, I just wanted her. And she was gone. If you would have told me at that time in my life that I could be happy and sober for the rest of my life, I'd punch you in the face. Not a guy like me. You have no idea what I've been through, the shoes that I've been walking in, and where my life is right now. No, please, God, if you exist, just take me off this planet, man. Take me off. I don't want to be sober. I don't want to be, you know, because I've felt so much pain for so long. And like when I'd come into the rooms and try this thing and I'm sitting down and like I see people happy, I'm so far from that. I think they're full of shit. I'm like, there's no way that guy lived the way I did and felt the way I felt and is happy. No way. Either he's high drinking or something. There's no way. You know? And from that point until I got sober, you know, the guy, there's a guy who took me through the steps the first time. And he always says this, and I believe that this was the situation I was in. I was running the streets so hard that I was hoping someone would put a bullet in my head. And if I had any air left in me, I'd say thank you. You know? Somehow, some way, I have this moment of clarity, right? I have this moment of clarity that, you know, maybe there's a shot for me. And I tried to go to treatment, and the doctor, I knew the doctor like pretty well. I've been in this place so many times, St. Joe's Detox, 16th and Girard, and I asked him to help me, and he's like, "Man, your insurance is so spent." And we spent probably, you know, a good part of the day calling different, you know, insurance companies like 20 times. And the best he could get for me was 23 hours detox and 5 days rehab or a maintenance program. So you guys can, you know, use your imagination. And I took the 6 days. I was like, 6 days off the street, okay, I think I can do this. And he loaded me up with so much medication, phenobarbital. It's actually a benzo. I don't know about anybody else, but when I take benzos, I like to steal. And it's funny, right? Yeah. And here goes the thing. It's so funny when we can get an Oscar for the roles that we play getting into treatment, you know? And then soon as they sign those papers and I'm in my paper scrubs and the booties, I'm like a boss and I'm making demands and I have all these expectations and rights. These are my rights here. I was demanding, they gave me a 60 milligram phenobarbital PRN, hour PRN. So every hour I can get 60 milligrams. Wow. I was caught behind the nurse's station stealing armbands, deodorant, pencils. I'm walking past people's hospital rooms like, yo, that armband's looking kind of crusty. I got some. You know, want to look at that, you know, and out of my mind. So these orderlies come to my room and they hit me with a shot of Ativan. It knocks me out for like 2 days. And they had to give me a one-on-one, which is a nurse that stands, well, sits in a chair in the threshold of your door. So when you wake up and you walk around, she can follow 3 feet behind you because you're like this and stuff, you know? So I wake up I wake up now, this time, like I swore off, I know relationships are issues and all this stuff, like no girl, but whatever. Well, I wake up in the TV room of the rehab section. I don't even remember getting to the rehab section. I was in detox, holding hands with this girl. And I look at her and I'm like, "Who are you?" And she's like, "I'm Melissa. I've been helping you make your cereal the last 3 days." I'm like, "I guess I'm obligated to a committed relationship." Needless to say, 2 weeks into it, our love can no longer be bound by the texts and CAs at this facility. So we decide, even though we get approved for 90 more days of treatment, we decide, you know what, we got this, and we're going to make a meeting immediately. And we leave, and I take her to the luxurious Hub Hotel on the Boulevard. They charge by the hour. I look at her, she looks at me. We didn't have to say anything. Went right to Kensington Avenue, and we spent about 2 weeks on the streets. And she was 19 years old. I was 23. And I know my situation is absolutely hopeless. I know I don't have a shot. St. Joe's was my last shot. But I know what's going to happen next for this girl. And I was across the street from the last stop. And I looked at her and I said, "You know what? There's a place across the street of some people that might be able to help you." And she's like, "I'm not going there." And I was like, and I already thought in my head, I've detoxed so many times that like I could probably do this cold turkey. Like if this girl can meet someone to help her and like I can just get away from her, because I'm such a piece of crap and my life is worth nothing, maybe there's a shot for her. So we walk across the street, and I don't know if any guys in here know Eddie Zambitella at the last stop, but I walk up to this guy and he's crazy, he's got the biggest heart in the world, but he's out of his mind. And I look at him and I'm like, "Hey, Ed." I mean, I knew him. And I was like, we need some help." And he looks at me, he goes, "Doll, this ain't no honeymoon suite. Kensington Avenue, like hole in the wall last stop." And this is in 2004 when it wasn't a tourist attraction. Like nobody was going to the last stop for meetings in 2004, I said, "Dude, we really need help." He goes, "Stay for the meeting." So we stayed for the meeting, and I tried to be like a fly on the wall and just stand against the brick wall, and hopefully he walks past. And I noticed that she was talking to some females, and they wanted to help her. And he comes over to me, and he's like, "She's coming with us. She's going to Gianeri." He's like, "There's a spot under the TV over there on the floor if you want it." And I said, "Thanks." And what happened that night, I didn't get much sleep. I was still intoxicated, but a guy spent till like 4 o'clock in the morning talking to me about a spiritual malady and a hole in the soul. I had no idea what the guy was talking about. But what I did remember the next day is that he spent that much time talking with me. And the guys that were surrounding me the next day were talking about the same thing. And I was like, "Huh, there's something different about this place, And by my third day, I was getting convinced that, maybe there's a shot. Maybe me and this girl can fight this thing together. Well, that afternoon, I find out that she slept with some other guy at Gianeri, and I'm convinced that God has cursed me if he exists, and I'm out. So I go to walk outside the last stop, and the guy who ended up becoming my sponsor, I didn't know at the time. He said, "Dude, you need to get in this car." And I was like, "No, I need a Newport and I'm out of here." And he's like, "No, man, you need to get in this car." I was like, "Where are you guys going?" And he's like, "Harbor City, Baltimore, Maryland." I'm like, "You guys are out of your minds. There's two more meetings here tonight. Why would you drive 2.5 hours to a meeting?" And they were like, "Anthony, please just get in the car." And he gave me a cigarette. And he, escorted me to the car. And I'm like, "All right, fine." So we start heading on 95 South. And I go to the driver, I ask him for a light, and he's like, "Dude, there's no smoking in this car." And I'm like, I'm like, "All right, well," they go to put a CD, and I'm like, "Maybe they got some cool music, And I'm like, "So who's that?" And they're like, "Tom Flynn." I'm like, "Who's Tom Flynn? A country singer?" They're like, "No, it's the speaker we're going to hear tonight." And I'm like, wait a second, man. We're driving 2.5 hours to hear a speaker that you have on CD in your car right now? Yeah. I thought they were freaks. I'm like, this is really crazy. So I went to sleep, and I woke up to what I considered for a long time a mecca of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was 300 people at that meeting that night. Tom Flynn was celebrating 24 years. And what that man said that night changed my life. I know the power of our actions. I know that. But we also, at least for me, I have to be very careful with my words as well, because words can be so powerful, because it changed my life that night. I found that there's this quote, and, you know, take it for what it is, you know, but I really, really dig it. It says that people may forget what you have said, people may forget what you have done, but people never forget the way you make them feel. And that man, that was the first night hope was transmitted inside of me. And he was talking about powerlessness. And I'll say this every time I'm at a podium. He said, it should be easy to surrender when there's nothing left to defend. I had nothing. No reason in the world to fight these guys who were trying to give me this hope and this way of life. None at all. I have no reason. So on the way back home that night, it changed my life. You know, I'm looking at these guys and they had such happiness. Like, they were laughing and they were talking about what Tom was talking about that night, the principles, and taking other guys through the steps, and going out of state to hear another speaker, and bringing a meeting to a hospital to a sick friend. It was the first time in my life I seen Alcoholics Anonymous in action. You know, actual active members of AA. Because you know what? I mean, I've been handed cards before and guys saying, hey, kid, if you feel like getting high or drinking, you call me, all right? And I look and I'm like, if I feel like getting high or drinking, I'm going to call my dealer or I'm going to the bar. Unless I can gain someone's trust, you know? But where I, you know, where my head was at, it was very hard for me to trust anyone. But he asked me a couple questions about alcoholism that I didn't even know. He was just asking me, he was qualifying me, and I had no idea. He said, Anthony, whether you're sober or not, do you feel that there's something wrong with you that you can't put your finger on that separates you from yourself and everyone around you to the point you feel like an alien in your own family? And I looked at him and was like, where have you been? Where have you been? Oh, my God. Finally, someone put in actual words what I've been feeling. I can feel like an alien at Christmas dinner with my family. You know, I got to go. I'm not, you know, I need to be somewhere else. And he said, Anthony, if you feel that way, 99.999% chance you suffer from a spiritual malady. He's like, the only remedy is a spiritual solution. He's like, I'm not going to tell you what God is or who God is, but you need to get happy as soon as possible. He's like, you don't have a shot. And that was my experience. And because I told him, like, he asked me, like, how, you know, I've never lasted more than 30 days. And that was, like, including maybe a detox, you know. I could never, my threshold for pain is like this sober. It's like this. And unless I have some kind of solution, that's why I'm saying, like, you know, the drink seems so much more attractive to me, you know, because, like, I'm already hurting. And all it takes, you know, and that's why, like, our words can be so powerful. And, like, we have to offer this to everyone possible, because I don't know many people that are walking into AA saying, man, I can't wait to have a spiritual experience as a result of the 12 steps. There's a lot of people looking for ways out, a way out of that room. And he had me when he said, Anthony, I found a way out. He's like, but the difference is I'm willing to show you, and that means tonight. And we ended up in his apartment that night, went through the doctor's opinion, the history, and the first three steps. And I was blown away. I'm like, I cannot believe I'm going through the steps. I cannot. Are you serious? I thought it was going to be this long road. I had a laundry list of items to look for in a sponsor from, you know, different recovery houses and stuff, you know, multiple years. This man had 5 months sober. 5 months sober. I didn't care about how much time he had. I didn't care about anything. Like, I knew he was happy, and he summed up my life in a couple questions. You know, I would have went anywhere that man asked me to. They talk about these four steps and like how it's like this dreary thing, or like just like so difficult. I can't believe these guys picked up a piece of crap like me and was willing to show me a different way of life. Just out of respect, I did it for these guys. So we do this four step, right? And I make my list. You know, first two is mom and dad, of course. And the first question is like, okay, Anthony, mom and dad, let me ask you, have you been a son? He's like, I'm not talking about five, six, or eight. When you're an adult and you actually can make adult decisions, where were you at? I'm like, Kensington, you know, completely absent. Third on the list, ex-girlfriend, dead ex-girlfriend's mom. Don't tell me that this person isn't messed up and sick, and I don't have a justifiable reason to hate this person. Don't tell me that. And he said, Anthony, I'm not going to tell you that, man. And he's like, but can you just put yourself aside for a second and just see that maybe this woman was trying to close a chapter in her life so she can get some sleep? Maybe there was a chance this girl didn't have a chance. He said, Anthony, however you want to take this, I'm telling you right now, unless you find a way out of this situation, find a way that you can see that you weren't the best boyfriend, you weren't the best anything to this family and this girl, you are never going to be free. He's like, do you want to die? Because this is the type of stuff that you have a decision to make. You can allow this to destroy you because look at you, like it can. Or you can really try to find in your heart that you can use this in a way that'll be useful to someone else in the future. I'm telling you, God will provide that situation. Man. It was the truth, though. And I wanted what he had so bad. And I wanted to be free. And I knew it was so evident that these guys had that freedom. I was willing to walk the way that they were walking, and they told me that there's a way out. But I have to do these things. I have to be absolutely willing to move through this stuff. So I became free of that. I became free. Like I asked God to remove it, and I started continuing to take actions. And I wasn't completely willing at first to let it go. But when I look at my part, you know, and what I'm capable of when I'm in pain, when I'm out there is no possible justification for resentment towards anyone. I can't muster it up because I can be that person, you know. So who the hell am I? Am I really going to be about this thing and try to be an instrument of God's love, power, and way of life? Or am I just going to continue to be in the way? So we started out further through the steps. Some amends that were just like miraculous to me. I made an amends that I didn't even know that I was making to my mom. I'm living on Kensington Avenue. You're not allowed to use the phone. I would sneak across the street once a week to the soup kitchen to call her to tell her I was okay. And the first phone call I made to her, she said, I recognize this number. There's no money available. I told you I would lose this number that I had for 20 years if you call again. If I see you, I'll call your parole officer and the cops. What do you want? All I know, Mom, is that there's something going on different here I'm feeling something different and I'm safe. I'm at Eddie Z's. I just wanted you to know that. Is that it? Yes. Okay. By the third week, my mom's offering me t-shirts, boxers, socks. I know they're living rough over there. Can you know? And I said no. And by the fourth week, she asked me again, like, is there anything I can do for you? And I said, yes. And I was like, can you please let me take you to the Oregon Diner in South Philly for breakfast? 2 years later, I get a phone call from my sister, and we're talking, and she's like reminiscing, you know. She's like, Anthony, you remember the first time you took mom out to breakfast? And I said, yeah. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, of course. And she's like, do you know what she said after you left? And I said, what? She said she called me immediately. And she said she knew her boy was going to be okay. Because the first time in her life that she tried to give everything she could to me, and all I wanted to do was do something for her. Unbelievable, you know? And it was because of doing that inventory and knowing how far off I was and how much of a piece of crap that I've been just by the way I looked at this world that I was compelled to try to do something for other people. And because of these actions, I was able to let go of everything. Because of more guys that I sat down with and I talked to and found out the roads that they've been down, I've been able to get more and more forgiveness. My son is 5 years old and has taught me, I mean, God put him in my life. He's like this like miracle AA baby. You know, my wife's in the program too. And, you know, this is kind of how, you know, I believe I suffer from a hopelessness that I'll never be able to explain, no matter how many times I get up here and try, you know. But the crazy thing is because of the result of these steps, I have a fulfillment in my heart that I'll never be able to explain. And the amount of gratitude I have for the teachers that I've come across in life, period, I'll never be able to put to words. I try to show it as much as I can because I got this little boy, and my dad's still an illegal entrepreneur. He drinks a case of beer a day, and he constantly wants to see his grandson. And my boy has this crazy relationship with him. He runs into the house. He runs right up on his lap, and he loves him to death. And it was brought to my attention that I can't be resentful. I have to let it go. I have to allow this relationship to happen. And the reason why is because if I turn my dad off, that's telling my son that it's okay to turn his dad off if I'm not doing what he likes. And the forgiveness part, I forgive my dad, you know, for being the crazy person he's been all these years and still doesn't see the light, no matter how long I've been sober, how much action I take, it doesn't matter. But my son, you know, when I look at him and I look at my father, I know that there may be a day, there may be a time that comes when I let him down. I may drink again. I may miss a like a really important game of his or something. And I'd want him to forgive me. You know? So like how can I be, you know, that judgmental and turned off that I can put someone out of my life? You know? When all this time, like God has been smacking me in the face to be more useful because I took so much out of life all those years. All those years, I was so convinced and concerned about what is best for me and what I can get. You know, I was told, Anthony, you need to stop taking and start giving. And it's been a wild, amazing ride, you know. But I've learned so much. You know, I had no idea on, how to be a dad, how to be a husband, and all these things. And believe me, like I can attest that AA isn't the best place to come to for relationship advice. But there's men that I've met that have made just ultimate sacrifices and amends with their families and their wives that I've been able to take some certain direction that is like completely clean the slate with me and mine. And that's like in our relationship. Like, seriously, like I really try to pray as much as I can. God, please, like, can you just like rip me out of the way of this one? Because like I'm tired of holding on to this. They say that this is a simple program. And yes, I do believe that it's simple, meaning the definition of the word is uncomplicated and direct. But it's definitely not easy. That's why my blood boils when I hear people say, "Hey, easy does it." Well, easy doesn't do shit. The definition of easy is effortless. Man, there's so much work that I have to do. Like, I've had the experience of like sponsoring half of Philadelphia. I mean, moms, grandma, like everything, And like, people may say, "Wow, that's some spiritual dude." No, that you are sick. Like, I was a sick pup. Not saying like I value that experience, and I live in Newtown, Pennsylvania. That's my home group, and I'm actually moving back to the city soon. Kind of want to be back on the firing lines. Some people may say I'm out of my mind or whatever. It just feels like home to me, and like the closer to the drunks, the better over there. I'm well aware of how delusional I can be. And that's why I say there's a way out for everyone, whether you're new, or you've been in AA and doing this deal for a while. There's just certain things that like I enabled to allow to crumble in my life because my hands just kept tightening because I wasn't willing to let go of certain things, And there's a way out of that. You just gotta be willing to see the truth. And walk through some of these fears because God has this amazing, beautiful situation on the other side of that, and that's been evident in my life. And I really appreciate you guys having me out, and thank you so much. That's all I have to share.